Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for coming along to this public lecture organised jointly by the International History Department and the European Institute of the London School of Economics. Today, the European Union, as you all know, faces several challenges. The dispute over the Growth and the Stability Pact, the fragile condition of the German banking system, the criminal investigation still hanging over the head of the governor of the Bank of France and the presumed successor to Wim Deutschenberg as chairman of the European Central Bank, all threaten the long-term future stability of the euro. The process of enlargement with its concomitant needs for agricultural reform and institutional change, now of course under review by the Convention on Europe's Future, threatens both to divide the Council of Ministers and perhaps to alienate Eastern Europe. The obvious disparity between ambition and resources in the field of foreign and security policy threatens to make the Union increasingly irrelevant in international affairs, while last but not least, the appalling record of corruption and incompetence revealed in the last 10 years or so among Europe's political leaders and commissioners has deprived the Union of some of its political legitimacy. Nor have its democratic credentials been strengthened by forcing small member states to rerun referendums when electorates have delivered unwelcome verdicts during the first referendum. Little wonder, therefore, that so few people bother to vote in European parliamentary elections. Still, whether we're Euro enthusiasts, Euro neutralists, Euro skeptics, Euro realists, or like myself, simply a professional Euro academic, we all agree that a stable, democratic, prosperous Europe, whatever shape it may take, is in the best interest of everyone. And hence it is supremely important that the challenges now facing the European Union are expertly analysed in the light of past experience. With this in mind, therefore, it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's guest speaker, one of the United States' leading experts on the European Union. No student here of the history of European integration will, I hope, be unfamiliar with his prize-winning book, Steel and the Rebirth of Europe, 1945-55, The Germans and French, From the Ruhr Conflict to Economic Community, and his other books on industry and politics in the Third Reich, on Belgian business under the Nazi New Order, will also, I'm sure, be known to very many of you. Then there are also his edited books on the foundation of NATO and on the United States and European integration. However, a few weeks ago, I was contacted by Cambridge University Press in New York and asked whether I'd be kind enough to agree to read his latest manuscript for them, a manuscript entitled Shadow to Sunrise, European Integration Between Superstate and New Market Economy. And when it's published next year, I think you'll all have to buy a copy of it. So take down the details. John Gillingham, Cambridge University Press, Shadow to Sunrise, European Integration Between Superstate and New Market Economy. Predictably, I was able to report to the CUP that John's work was both extremely original in its analysis and, as usual, extremely amusing to read. All future histories of the European Union will have to come to terms with it, indeed, will have to measure up to it. Ideally, they'd love to give you some quotes from the book or hint at the radicalism of its judgments on both people and events. But since these are so independent and since they'll likely upset both Europhiles and Eurosceptics, I think my best course of action is simply to hand over to John Gillingham himself and allow him to talk about his own interpretation of where the European Union has been and where perhaps it is now heading. John, over to you.
It's an immense honor. Is this okay? Can you hear me okay? It's an immense honor to be here, walking the corridors of the LSE, in the midst of the shadows of great economic theorists, great figures in the history of integration. I'm thinking of people like Hayek, Lord Robbins, Alan Millward, Jacques Delors, I believe, has also spoken here, and then finally, Alan Skidd. What would integration be without him? I very much appreciate the pitch for the book as well. I have very large mortgages on two properties, and I'm looking to the book to make it possible for me to at least see something of my paycheck. Either that or hope that maybe it will get me a promotion, which is also long overdue. But I do want to say one simple thing, and that is that although the book is in certain ways, let's say in many ways, outspoken, tries to be witty and readable, is certain to insult. Its purpose is not radical but conservative. I'm trying to encourage future historians to write the history of integration in the way I think it should be written, but hasn't been up to date. I think that in many ways the subject remains confusing because those who have dealt with it have in certain respects been blinkered and other respects been committed to strong ideological positions. In other respects been captured by the language of integration itself, which involves neologism after neologism. It involves transforming the meaning of words and placing them in new contexts. It involves imposing a teleological logic on events. So I see my book as a first, certainly not the last book on integration. And with that in mind, I'd like to get into the subject itself. Now, this lecture is called Journey Without End or End of Journey, European Integration in Historical Perspective. Now, it's tempting to answer the question that I raised, journey without end or end of journey, simply by saying, take your choice. The process of integration, it seems, churns on endlessly without getting anywhere. Only those who hold to a teleology, perforce, know where it is headed. Others, like myself, without foreknowledge, mere mortal human beings with only imperfect understanding, would be apt to agree with the provocative, but in some cases, unhelpful judgment of Lord Schoenfield that Europe, to take a title given his famous lectures on the BBC, is an unknown destination. And since the destination is unknown, we also know, as good physicists, that the timetable is unknown. He or she who would attempt tracking or plotting the course of integration in order to determine where it is headed would be well advised to begin at the beginning, more or less step by step, carefully moving forward, and then, after having reached a few tentative conclusions as to how and why and under what conditions the progress has occurred, arrive at serviceable hypotheses about its first future development. This, of course, is the approach of the historian. But the historian's craft normally requires not only a knowledge of origins, but a knowledge of outcomes, and that is not vouchsafed the student of the ongoing present. Thus, to make sense of European integration, its present and future in relation to its past, one must look within the subject itself for a pattern, a scheme, a principle of order, for rules and laws governing behavior. One must draw heavily on social scientific analysis. I've done so in the book, but will spare you lengthy commentary concerning my method in the belief that the subject matter is itself of greater interest to you. So what then is European integration? A figment or phenomenon of an overheated bureaucratic nerve center in Brussels that twists words and ideas into rules and regulations which strip nations and their citizens of freedom? Or is it a slow-moving, long-term, imperfectly functioning agent of human betterment? The book itself reaches a number of conclusions about this matter, which for reasons of brevity, I can merely state as assertions. So here are a list of assertions that I think are very important to the way I look at the subject. Assertion number one, European integration is mutable, by which I mean its purposes, mechanisms, and consequences differ substantially over from time to time and change over time. It is a subject that is fundamentally historical in character. Assertion number two. Over most of the 50-year history of European integration, it has been an epiphenomenon or artifact of history. It has developed, in other words, or develops in response to more salient, powerful currents and forces, which themselves also change over time. So taken together, those things mean you can't look at integration by itself, but only in this larger context of events. Assertion number three, the process can be viewed, and this is a lot of words strung together, as an asymmetrical, three-level interdependence game. It could begin at the international or national level, but also at the interface between them, namely the European level, and neither its origins, course, nor consequences can be predicted except perhaps as probabilities. Assertion number four. Although the integration process can unfold in different ways, it can yield constructive results only via one of them. The route invidiously described in the political science literature and the economics literature as negative integration. So long, that is, as a single condition remains unsatisfied, the condition, namely, is the existence of a European demos, or sense of nationhood. This demos, then, is the real phantom that stalks the subject of integration. When might such a demos be created and come into existence? 50 years? A century? Never? Surely your answer is as good as mine. And how should it come into existence? This matter cannot be trivialized. It has become clear since the early 1990s that the attempt to stuff the Strasbourg goose while yet yielding few truffles does appear to have caused some form of pernicious long-term liver disease, which unless cured could have fatal consequences. But before turning to such interesting dietary, gastronomic, and medical issues, I'd like to say a few words about the humdrum matter of definition, starting with the wimpy-sounding negative integration. For it, substitute the more positive term of integration through the market, because that's essentially what it means. As for its more potent, robust, and adventuresome counterpart, positive integration, substitute integration by institution building. So I'm talking about integration through the market, which is the one that I think that works, and integration by institution building, which is somewhat more complicated, but only works in conjunction with the former. Integration by institution building can occur in two ways. It can be intergovernmental, that is, work by means of councils comprising the elected heads of the European democracies, or it can work functionally, that is, be built upon the framework of the Commission in Brussels and operate according to a dynamic intrinsic to the integration process. That's another fundamental political science theory developed by Ernst Haas of Berkeley in the 1960s. Positive integration, that is, institutional integration, can be either market improving or market correcting. In other words, one can build institutions for the purpose of facilitating the market of the operation or by transforming it in a way that serves social values. The impact of institution building or integration through the market can be either positive or negative, and either long or short term. The important thing, in my view, is to bear in mind that institution building cannot substitute for integration through the market. It can either help it or hurt it, but it cannot promote integration in the absence of the market. It can advance it, that is to say, institution building can advance integration through the market, but it can also delay, or otherwise impede progress. Now, the book itself doesn't deal as extensively with theory as my words would indicate, but the theory is implicit in the way I set up the integration scenario, if you want. And it devotes considerable time to explaining how the historical process of integration unfolds. I'll spare you all that. I lack the time to talk about it. But I do want to say that the fundamental to the story of integration is the tension between two principles of order namely the market or the state, excuse me, the market on the one hand and the state on the other. Yet outcomes also depend on other things. They depend on unknowns, the unpredictable element, huge human agents, so to speak, human beings, if you're more of a humanist, but also upon endogenous events. And one of them has been of paramount importance. It is the collapse of what the eminent Columbia University political scientist John Ruggie, R-U-G-G-I-E, termed the embedded liberal system. That is, the one supported by the framework of international monetary institutions created at the famous Bretton Woods Conference of 1944 to buffer the mixed economy welfare states from exogenous shocks stemming from world trade. The collapse of the world monetary system in the 1970s broke the link between the regulated international monetary order operating within the framework of the Bretton Woods institutions and the mixed economy welfare state. In other words, it broke the link internationally and nationally, but also broke the link between the state and the economy within the nation, opening a new period, a new historical era, in which the market shaped the state rather than, as before, the state the market. In other words, it didn't bring about a revolutionary upheaval immediately. It changed the relative power of market and state. This regime change, to use a word which has been made instantly obsolescent by the foreign policy rhetoric of the American president over the last 2 weeks, but for which I haven't had a chance to go back and find a substitute in the text, I'll call it a regime change with apologies. This regime change had vast implications for European integration. It shifted it from the realm of frustrated planning and projections, characteristic of Euro-pessimism between 1965 and early 1980s, shifted it from there into the sphere of constructive and consequential action. Real change became possible. European integration could enter a new dimension. But before I delve into the period of really significant change, which is the recent one, allow me to, I should say, the luxury of an historian's aside. What I am arguing in political economic terms, to restate the earlier proposition in a way that historians might find more useful, what I'm saying, in other words, is that a break occurred in the mid-1970s that was of even greater importance than the one that occurred in 1945 between the end of the Second World War and the beginning of the post-war period. The break that occurred earlier, I call the shift from warfare state to welfare state. It involved a shift of emphasis, or change of emphasis within the same overall system. The break of the 70s witnessed the replacement of one system, the embedded liberal system, with another system, the new market economy. I'm not sure what the long-term implications of this fact are, but I think we should view its significance in light of the open-ended character of contemporary history. So this is the really important change, in my view, and for my subject, the one that occurred in the 1970s. Changed the meaning of integration substantially, the possibilities. I call it a new realm of possibility in the book. Later on this evening, I'll speak about integration within the context of the new market economy. But before doing that, I'd like to explain why development was so slow between 1965 and 1985, the era of Euro-pessimism. Now, the usual explanation given for it, which contains a powerful and persuasive partial truth, is that the lack of progress on the integration front was due to the upshot of the empty chairs crisis precipitated when General de Gaulle walked out from the European Council and refused to come back until the Commission accepted his terms, which was the introduction of the liberum veto that made it possible for any one of the six to block legislation going through the Council. Well, this was for sure a formula for paralysis. But there was a more salient problem facing Europe than the political one. And it was explained even avant la lettre, before the facts, by the eminent Swedish, this is a surprising figure, economist Gunnar Myrdal, in a book written in 1954 called An International Economy, a touchstone, if you want, to a more elaborate theory developed by the well-known Dutch economist, perhaps the leading economic expert on integration, Jacques Peltmans, in an article called, somewhat awkwardly, The Assignment of Public Functions in Economic Integration, where he relies heavily on public choice theory. Now, the gist of both Myrdal's and Peltmans' position is that under conditions of the mixed economy, on the one hand, and representative democratic institutions on the other, the mixed state the power of the national bureaucracies and corporate sector enterprises was too strong at the national level to be dislodged. In other words, there was no way, under the given set of conditions, that powerful national bureaucrats or industry that was either owned by the state or captive of state policy would willingly relinquish these privileges. It would take some kind of a radical shuffling of the cards, some redistribution of power, to make it possible for the mixed economy welfare state to integrate at the European level, integrate willingly. And Myrdal sought a solution, I'll just mention parenthetically, in a kind of moral crusade. The functionaries of the European Commission sought more practical ways of dealing with it. Peltmans said it was simply impossible and recommended that integration proceed along the lines, the negative lines that I described earlier on. The historical record, indeed, underscores the failure of successive attempts to introduce planning or its attenuated stepdaughter, economic coordination at the European level. There's a long record of this. I want to cite only two instances that I think are interesting. The one was Monet's in 1948 to introduce European-wide planning based upon the institution of similar or homologues to the French plan in all of the recipient states. Thus, it would be European-wide planning, state by state, kind of peeking into a pyramid directorate of European level planning along the French line. This got nowhere, although it was a very serious proposal. Similarly, in the early years of the Commission, under the first president, Walter Hallstein, president of the Commission, the Commission's policy was to introduce economic coordination, which involves the gradual development the creation development of planning machinery in all of the six member nations, which later would be coordinated by the Commission itself. This was a very serious campaign, and it too got nowhere. Indeed, the historical record will also bear out that the transference of power of economic decision-making authority from the national level to the European level has been the exception rather than the norm, and then has occurred only on a sectoral basis and has seldom enjoyed even a moderate degree of success. Now, this is a very big subject, but let me say that the most spectacular failure in sectoral planning has been the common agricultural policy, but there are many others. The coal and steel community, though an enormous diplomatic and political triumph, was an economic failure. Euratom was a non-starter. The Davignon plans of the 70s and early 80s and their counterparts in other industries like textiles and shipbuilding were expensive and anti-innovative. The various framework programs to promote a European research and development policy, there are now, what, six of them, have been consistent failures, wasteful, incentive warping, and corrupting. I think it's fair to say that the full extent of this record of disappointment, shortcoming, and waste is not well known. I think it's also safe to say that the mainsprings of the integration accomplishment are also little appreciated. There are really two important things in the history of integration, as I see it. The first, of course, is the Treaty of Rome, a liberal framework document that set up the mechanisms for introducing a customs union and enforcing the laws that made competition fair. The second great achievement is, of course, the Single European Act of 1986 that has opened up the possibility of complete, I should say, creating a market with complete factor mobility, still far from realized. Let me make a second aside. This more as a pseudo-economist than an historian. But I think it's also safe to say that the economic importance of these two acts has been difficult to explain. Economic theory has not yet convincingly isolated anything like a variable that would explain the impact of that thing called integration. Nor has any economist ever come up with a theory of endogenous economic development. The closest to it is Balassa, and as Pelkmans has remarked in several important articles, he too relies heavily on institutional presuppositions and prerequisites for the unfolding of the integration process. Very difficult to measure, in other words. Thus, when one tries to demonstrate its economic impact, inevitably there must be a resort to, you know, structural issues, institutional changes, and intuitive judgments. And one's judgment must depend upon a preponderance of evidence. Now, having made those brief comments, let me get back to the narrative. Why did integration resume in the 1980s? The SEA was an epiphenomenon of globalization on the one hand and the neoliberal reforms of the national governments on the other, and thus also consequences of the regime change it set in the 70s. The changes that occurred in national policy were due, as you surely all must recognize, to the failure of Keynesian policy to overcome the stagflation of the era. But these explanations, I think, only account in part for the restoration, if you want, of progress along the integration front. There were other ingredients. There were human ones, and there were exogenous ones. Make no doubt about it, the Single European Act was Margaret Thatcher's baby. It still amazes me in the literature that others are given credit for it. Amazes me less now that she's disowned it herself, but that's another story. But she was the founding mother of New Europe. Monsieur Delors did not even provide the ignition needed for conception. One might also note, however, that the creation of the European Council by Helmut Schmidt and Giscard d'Estaing in the 70s was an important institutional prerequisite for the SEA negotiations, and it seems difficult to imagine them occurring without it. The Single European Act, with which you are all familiar, called for the removal of all remaining non-tariff barriers to the free movement of goods. And going even further than American antitrust law, extended into the powers of the state as well as the private sector. The Single European Act, as implemented, has weakened, though not broken, the power of state monopolies, especially in the fields of transportation and networking, the networking industries, has established the supremacy of the competition principle, which is currently under attack, in rulemaking, and enforced not only prohibitions of anti-market commercial policies, but asserted with some effectiveness or with considerable effectiveness the right to block mergers and acquisitions that would result in the formation of monopolies. It has also encouraged or brought about a host of important secondary developments. It's increased capital mobility and strengthened capital markets. It's created new markets for goods and services, reduced costs in many different ways, imposed a measure of fiscal discipline on governments, introduced a measure of competition into the provision of public services, promoting the principle of marketization. All these things relate in some way to the Single European Act. Yet, as you know, Margaret Thatcher, recently in Statecraft, Strategies for a Changing World, has in effect, abandoned her child to the elements. In this book, she accuses Jacques Delors of having misapplied the principle of subsidiarity, in effect, perverted it, turning it from a mechanism, if you want, of market opening and market development into one to facilitate the imposition of central control from Brussels as a first step towards creating a European federal state. Well, she's right regarding Delors' intentions, but wrong about outcomes. The Delorean agenda, as I call it in the book, which is, some of you may be old enough to remember, refers to the sports car that a certain John Delors of Detroit, Michigan, built at the expense of the taxpayers of Northern Ireland. It was a very nice looking car when I saw a picture of it. It had gull wings like the old Mercedes. It had a burnished silver like yuppie refrigerator doors. But beneath this somewhat slick skin was just a Renault with a sturdy little engine that would climb up hills at perhaps an acceptable cost. No one had looked beneath the skin of this car. No one had bothered to ask why it was that the factory that had been built to create some 5,000 jobs had no machines in it, let alone any employees. It was a while before the good people of Northern Ireland realized that they had been done in by a flim-flam man. And a flim-flam man is an expert at bait and switch. He promises you one thing and you get another. To be a flim-flam man, you have to have complete confidence in what you're doing in order to stay one degree, one step ahead of the next guy. How do you do it? You do it by keeping him off balance. Now, in a very interesting book by George Ross, which I recommend simply because it's a fascinating read, and extraordinarily acutely written, Ross lets it be known that within the European Commission, Delors followed a strategy called that of the Russian dolls in order to push through his agenda. The Russian dolls, well, you all know what they are, right? These wooden things that screw together, one inside the other, nested, tight. Each time you open a doll, there's a new face on it, right? It's always curious. You never know what to expect next. One smiles, one frowns, one looks the other way, one may be looking sort of peasant-like and the other refined. You never know what it's quite going to be as it unfolds. Well, this is exactly how his strategy unfolded, keeping all of the opposition off balance until in the end he could present the ultimate doll, which is a solid little thing about an inch high with a grin on it that says, "I've won the game." Well, it was Delors' toy. It was Delors' game. And as the DeLorean agenda unfolded, through the Delors 1, which is his package, through the EMU, and so on and so forth, there was regional policy. I won't go into all the details. He pushed harder and harder and harder for his agenda at raising the stakes, you know, pushing the integration program forward. But in the end, when he opened that last door, what did he see? Well, he saw the strange, curled, golden hair held together by some form of invisible plastic, the bright blue eyes staring out in space, the arched eyebrows, the shiny white biting teeth, and the bowed lips of Margaret Thatcher. So this is what happened to the DeLorean agenda in my view. As carefully as the strategy was plotted, it did not work as intended. Margaret left today, I'm sure, is probably having a drink. It's probably about that hour, isn't it? Not quite yet for her, I guess. Anyway, bewailing the perversion of subsidiarity and the sinkage of the Single European Act. And Delors is doing the same thing in wherever it is he has his boutique farm out in the Vosges. But Margaret's won the game. It's her Europe. It's not Jacques'. The flim-flam man got flim-flammed himself by someone who didn't realize that she'd done it. Okay. As I say, Margaret Thatcher is correct in her assessment of Monsieur Delors' intentions, but wrong about outcomes. The European Union has become a shambles in the 1990s. This should be obvious. I think it's hard to amplify on Alan's introductory remarks, but summit after summit has failed. The Commission has become a farce and is so treated at these summits. I can only say that it seems to me that Professor Prodi or Monsieur Prodi, whatever we're going to call him, seems to be a wildly spinning compass. I don't see the direction that he's pointing. The Commission itself is indolent, increasingly corrupt, directionless, and can treated with bald-faced contempt by the heads of state. The decade has booked few successes in the field of integration, but witnessed the persistence of old problems and even the appearance of a few new ones. The framework programs have failed with predictable regularity. The regional programs, under whatever name, entrenched pockets of privilege that and cannot be properly regulated or supervised. The CAP seems unreformable. The EMU, it is becoming sadly evident, is an historic mistake. Bad economics and worse politics. And I think it will come undone. And just around the corner, enlargement looms, which in the absence of some 11th hour reprieve, will be added as the latest chapter in this catalog of mounting disaster. The EU will have betrayed the greatest pledge it ever made to bring the former captive nations of Eastern Europe into a common European home. The accession countries have, in fact, been cheated and misled. And so long as this remains the case, there will be a problem, whether within the European Union or outside it. Yet, and this is really my final word, the 1990s are only an episode in a long 50-year history of integration. A reversal in a process that has been one of two steps forward, one step back. Bear in mind that for 20 years, nothing happened at all. 10 years aren't so bad. Doesn't mean that there aren't looming dangers out there. The achievements of European integration are real and worth building upon. European integration has been a great civilizing influence and contributed critically, though in varying degrees, to peace, prosperity, the rule of law, and democracy. But if it is to advance, sound approaches must be applied, and the integration process rescued from those who claim to be its guardians. The power to create a closer union of the peoples of Europe must devolve upon those peoples, must be returned to them and allowed to develop as they choose, gradually, constructively, and with a view towards promoting economic growth. Exercises like the Flucht nach vorne, as it's called in German, of the present Constitutional Convention will lead nowhere except backwards. I have no instant remedies. The business cycle has entered a downturn. The end of it is not in sight. The European polity and public is weary, disaffected, and risk-averse. The Germans appear both unable and unwilling to lead, and the French appear to have abandoned the hope that their marriage will last. Enlargement will create vast new problems over the medium term. It is impossible to determine or to perceive what, if anything, will provide an impetus to integration in the near future. Is it then a journey without end, or the end of the journey? The only obvious lesson that one can draw, I think, from my hasty review of the integration process is that the wrong approach to advancing it, the attempt to create centralized bureaucratic institutions for Europe in the absence of a demos, can only delay, misguide, or even derail the integration process. It will have to develop in its own time and its own way and require the sound operation of a modern competitive economy.
Well, those who can't wait for questions can leave now. We'll wait for a minute, and then any of you have questions, would you be kind enough to get them ready? And there are people with microphones, both on the balcony and on the ground floor, who will assist you if you put your hand up if you want to ask a question. So I'll take questions in a moment. I think we've got the hardcore Euro this and Euro that left, so we'll take questions in a minute. As I understand you, John, what you were arguing was that in the course of the history of European integration, most of the things done by Monsieur Monnet and Monsieur Delors and organized centrally by the Commission have failed. That which was organized in market lines by Margaret Thatcher succeeded, although she doesn't seem to see this herself. In the future, there are all sorts of challenges which look fairly ominous. I got the impression that your advice would be more or less keep things as they are and perfect the market economy as it's working in Europe without going any further. But do you think Europe, tied to a process of ever closer union, can actually stand still?
I don't see why not. I think probably the most powerful idea in the literature is the bicycle principle, that if you don't move forward, you fall over sideways. But as Timothy Gartnash said in an article, you know, that forgets that people have legs. If the bicycle stands still, they just straddle their legs and they don't fall over. That's something you learn fast when you learn how to ride a bicycle, and I think it applies now. In other words, I think that in the early history of integration, it was touch and go, that wrong moves could potentially be fatal. They weren't, interestingly enough, because there was the power, the desire for reconciliation was strong enough to overlook, for instance, great problems in the operation of the coal and steel community, which was really unpopular with everyone involved. For this reason, Monet was kept at a distance from the Messina negotiations that led to the Treaty of Rome. And so it goes down further. There's failure after failure, instance after instance, and yet, and more failure by far than success, probably. Nevertheless, integration continued. Now, another point, an important point, I think, that should be mentioned is that although, the cliche is that the European institutions brought about the reconciliation of peoples. I'm not denying that. But I think this must be seen also in the larger setting of American security policy. NATO is perhaps the most boring subject known to man, or woman, or anyone, because it never does anything, right? It is the only military engagement that it's ever actually been involved in was Bosnia. That's the proof of its success. It's not a war-fighting organization. It's a security organization that eliminates traditional kinds of diplomatic problems between states in Europe. NATO is a very important background fact. But so I don't think that, and in the meantime, the markets have developed increasingly in a manner that makes the European states interdependent. And it has done so at times even in spite of policy. To give you an example, even in the 1970s, particularly the late 70s, it's a period of neo-protectionism. There are great writers like Jan Tumlier who talk about the dangers of it, and they're real. Nevertheless, international trade increased. Foreign investment increased. European markets developed, and so on and so forth. In other words, the economic momentum keeps integration moving forward. That's my basic argument. As I say, even in spite of Monsieur Delors' attempt to dam it, control it, channel it, divert it into his constructive purpose, I don't see that either politically or economically a lack of progress will result in the collapse of European institutions. They are ingrained, if you want, I say this in the book, it is now an historical subject. It is a given. as I say, old line diplomacy between European states has been institutionalized. It's not important. Yes, I know we have foreign offices and we have people talking, you know, about the Cyprus problem in Luxembourg and so on and so forth. But they're mechanisms for dealing with these problems. This is all history. Nobody can seriously turn away from the liberalization of international trade, the promotion and encouragement of international capital mobility, the development of tendencies and trends that develop the favoring of large and efficient capital markets. These things that we kind of subsume under the heading of globalization are givens. May be able to deal with the consequences of them, but you cannot stop them. I don't want to be an apostle of Tina doctrine, which has got a very ugly ring here. There is an alternative to it, but there's no substitute for it. There's an alternative to Tina doctrine, but there's no substitute for it. So I would say that, you know, I don't want to give an over-lengthy answer, but in the future, there are many minds that are more acute and more specialized than my own that have laid out scenarios for, let us say, a non-institution building development of laws, institutions, and regulations that encourage integration and also facilitate the operation of a market. And basically, the approach is empirical and problem-solving. And this emphasis, you can go back, I think, if you want, I referred to Andrew Schoenfeld's wonderful book, Europe, an Unknown Destination. He was saying the same things back in the 70s. And so, too, was another eminent integration figure who certainly deserves to have been mentioned, and even in my introductory remarks, and that's Lord Dahrendorf, said the same things in the 70s. But this is really the way that it has developed, functionally, if you want to not use a capital F functionalism that I described as an American political science theory. When problems have to be solved, people get together and solve them. They don't have to create an institution to solve them. The institution grows out of the solution of the problem. And this is a very standard and traditional approach. And the effort to find, I can give you an example. Such things as the effort to revise banking legislation, come out with international standards, the Basel, efforts to change actuarial practices that have grown out of all the recent scandals. These things continue to advance, you know, even in the absence of, if you want, developments at the top level.
Okay, thanks. Questions, please. Tom.
You said that Margaret Thatcher was the most important single figure in the creation of the Single European Act and the shape it took. Why do you think she was? I mean, what are the grounds you base this on, that she's more important than, say, the President of the Commission? And secondly, if that is so, why is it that she's turned against it, do you believe?
Okay, well, I can try to answer it simply. Because the man who designed the Single European Act program, Lord Cofield, was her man. She organized the, instituted his appointment, and he executed her ideas faithfully, at least up to the point of designing a single European Act. And there's a history behind this too. This was part of a very serious plan. I won't go into it, but there's no question about the fact that she was the power behind it, and Cofield was the man who designed it. And claims to the contrary, and there are many made, that someone named Vissa Decker was important, who was the president of Philips and set up something called the European Roundtable, which was like a cabal of leading industrialists. They had ideas that sounded similar but had a different purpose behind them, and they were not directly involved in the process, nor was Jacques Delors. Jacques Delors accepted the Single European Act because the Treaty of Rome establishes competence to create a common market, a functional market. It was a field in which the Commission power could develop unchallenged. He also believed that, without understanding why, that efficient markets were necessary to national strength. So he had the notion that he could expand Commission power, promote economic growth, but eventually seize control of the process and direct it to what he thought would be constructive channels, which was the promotion of European champions, for instance. And this is where the research and development policy. And this is the bet that he lost. The Single European Act did not develop as intended, at least as Delors intended. It developed more along the lines that Thatcher intended. It did not produce a balanced economic European social agenda based upon something called the European social model, but dissolve traditional kinds of structural barriers between industry, promoted the spontaneous development of markets, set history off on a course that escaped the control of the commission.
All right, next question. Gentleman, the red.
Given your gloomy outlook, is it your opinion that the EU should attempt to become more like the US?
More like the US? I would say on the contrary. I think... pardon? Do you mean politically, I take it? Or?
You seem to be very focused on market-based solutions, which is how I see the US being focused. Do you think Europe should continue to go down that direction?
Yes, I do. But I mean, when you talk about the American model, the first thing that comes to my mind is the federal model, and it is singularly inappropriate for Europe. I think one must ask a very painful question, and that is, do you want to be governed by Germans? I mean, you know, let's cut to the quick here and not waste a lot of time. No, everyone admires and respects the Germans in Europe, but the Danish don't want to be governed by them, neither do the Dutch. The Belgians might want, but then they want to be governed by anyone. The Italians don't want to be governed by anyone now but the Italians, and the Spanish don't want to be governed even by the Spanish. The British look upon we regard the question, I think, as simply preposterous and inconceivable. But the point is that that is, and I mean, if you had a choice, ideally, would you, you know, the point is that it's not politically, it's something that has to kind of be said openly without a certain amount of shame. It's certainly not something that this generation of Germans has earned, but it happens to be the truth. Until you're willing to have your decisions made for you in Berlin or in some outpost of Berlin, I think that European, you as British or as French or as Italians or as Spanish or as Polish, then I think European federalism is not in the cards. And that's why I said, you know, 10, 50, 100 years, things may have changed sufficiently. A great, you know, a third world war might kind of shake up the mixture a little bit. As for the American model, this is a very embarrassing time to talk about it. I'm not sure that there is such a thing. I'm certainly, what I do know is that it did not develop according to anyone's theory. You know, supply-side economics is shake-and-bake economics based upon very traditional notions. That they worked tells us something about the unwisdom of all the experts who said they couldn't work because they didn't add up. But there is no American scheme or model. It grossly, I think, oversimplifies American policy to believe that we're capable of such a thing. It's such a sprawling, disorganized country that the trouble is, I mean, the problem is that that the United States is big and powerful, and God knows, at the very least, Europe will have to adopt some of its methings and trappings to defend its interests. What they are, I am somewhat loath to say, but I do want to make one comment, and that's that the defenses are often the wrong ones. To give you an example, on the EMU, well, the EMU is sold as a means of convenience to, you know, because it saves the European citizen and the tourist of changing money from one currency into another. It will make costs more transparent, all this kind of thing. Yes, surely this is one part of it, but not the most important. The most important part, I think, if you trace back to the history of the discussions around the monetary union, it's to build a capital market. You know, dating back to the 1960s, European capital markets are minuscule, not big enough for the requirements of industry. And so what developed was the euro dollar market, the euro yen market, and so on. So European markets did develop, they just weren't denominated in European currencies. But the need for a European capital market is fundamental to the monetary union. But who has benefited from the European capital market? Who's benefited from the EMU? It's the big American banks. Which banks deal on a European level, a European scale? It's not the, you know, the Kreditkassen in Nordrhein-Westfalen. It's the people who are here in the city. I have a quote in my book, and I'm sure the person from Goldman Sachs who provided it to the journalist of the Daily Telegraph regrets it. But he said, truthfully, he said, for us, the European Monetary Union is a killing ground. It promotes American banks. Look, if you want to buy shares in them, it's a good idea. But if you imagine that it's going to stimulate the creation of some kind of something comparable to Wall Street in Paris or Bonn, you better look closer. What's going on? The European defense and security policy is another false lead. I mean, even with something as preposterous as Iraq, you have four different positions represented among the four leading European powers. This is hardly surprising. How can you have a defense policy without an army? How can you have a security policy without the means of coercion to enforce it? I'm not saying that you shouldn't. I'm just saying that the notion that you can expect it to work is preposterous and will only lead to repeated Bosnians. So I agree with you that the problems of defenses against this 800-pound gorilla, this colossus in spite of itself, must be built. I hope that you know how to build them.
Well, there's a few hostages to fortune. Any more questions? The gentleman at the back there.
You touched on it a number of times in your remarks just then, and I was thinking about you, when you first started off, you spoke of the elusiveness of forming a European demos, a united European identity, and sort of that was the elusive quality missing.
I say phantom
EU.
Quality. Phantom the phantom quality. Of the demos, yeah.
Is that possible without the military aspect? In other words, is a crucial ingredient of forming a common identity the willingness to go and fight and die for one another, a common security policy? In other words, without that, will there or can there ever be a united Europe?
Well, I suppose the question is, can you unite Europe in the absence of the sorts of developments that have united nations in the past? Revolution, war, conscription. I don't know, but again, the question presupposes that the teleology, and that is that the outcome of integration is the creation of a federal state. And I don't think it has to be. I think it can be something that is radically confederal, that grows, out of the unwritten constitution of Europe according to need, and which, I'm sorry to be vague about it, but it will grow essentially out of regulatory functions, the need for common standards, not only accounting standards, process standards, binding law. I don't think it necessarily has to be centered in any one place, be it Brussels, even the community isn't. I think in some respects the community is already developing along these lines, perhaps not always optimally. For instance, where does the European Monetary Union fit in to the Maastricht system, politically? It doesn't. It's a pillar all by itself, sitting out there in Frankfurt. It's not in Brussels. It's not subject to the control of Brussels. I mean, now Prodi does an Indian dance around the place saying that it should be. Let's see how it works. Let's see if you can start loosening up these constrictive requirements and still maintain a common monetary union. But the point that I'm trying to make is not to attack the EMU, but to say that this kind of development has already occurred outside the framework of the Commission. The intergovernmentalism, the creation of the European Council, is also another very important instance, a critical one, in which new machinery is created to take over from the Commission. There's nothing in the Treaty of Rome that calls for such a thing, and yet without it, I think it would have been much more difficult to revive the European integration in the 1980s. So I'm saying much of this is already happening or has happened. It may occur in the field of the environment. I don't know. There may be some sort of separate authority to deal with it. There's no particular reason why the Commission should deal with it. It doesn't. The advance of integration can involve a diffusion of power rather than centralization of it, in my view. How it exactly will occur, I tell you, the most interesting person to read on this is Gian Domenico Maggioni, you know? He'll...
You had a question, yes? And then Paul Taylor after that, then Colin Bullen after that.
Yeah, two quick questions, John. First one about the journey ahead. Is the journey ahead for the EU institutions similar to that of Germany today? That's to say, secular decline, institutional sclerosis, but without a real crisis on the horizon to really shake things up. In other words, are you projecting more of the same into the future, unless there is some kind of deus ex machina? Second question relates to what you said earlier about positive integration. Now, you spoke of it largely in uncharitable terms, and I agree with your sentiment, but you did sneak in a comment that some forms of institution building can actually conduce to more and better markets. Now, doesn't that allow some room in the future for more common institutions at the EU level that might actually promote the kind of negative integration you advocate?
Yes, it's on, let me take them one at a time. Is progress, let us say, on the integration front consistent with secular decline and institutional sclerosis? I think in theory it is, although it hasn't been tested. Integration didn't fall apart in the 70s. It wasn't secular decline, but it was certainly 10 years of it. It revived somehow. And I think the answer to institutional sclerosis is simply abandon the old house and build a new one. You know, just walk away from it. Don't try to restore it. We know that restoration is three times as expensive as greenfield construction. So just let it sit. Bureaucracies never die; they're just replaced. And I think on this basis, it can proceed. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to judge or to design regulatory institutions that promote the market. Many attempts to do so fail. We've had spectacular instances of it in the last year. How do you improve the SEC? You know, well, you have to keep one step ahead of the game of the people who are moving big money in Wall Street. It's unfortunate that so many institutions that are created, like subsidiarity, to open markets, to remove the heavy hand of central regulation, succeed in reimposing an undesirable kind of regulation through the back door. All I can say is that I don't rule out the possibility that sound institutions can be made that work at least on a temporary basis. Where and what and how specifically they'll operate, I can't go into at this point, partly because I lack the expertise, partly because each case is something that has to be handled in and of itself. Many of them involve principles of self-regulation. Rather than have a simple central rule imposed by an impersonal, in theory, objective authority, you bring in the interested parties. They arrive at compromises that are effective in part because they're based on expert knowledge, in part because they're based on a realistic assessment of the way power is distributed, be it in a specific branch of industry or in some other field. But rules become permanent and therefore, by definition, exclusive in a fast-evolving society. The groups that might be able to make reasonable determination, set rules for the conduct of environmental policy may not be the ones that are affected by it 5 or 10 years down. And then you're back into the issue of how do you make bureaucracies responsive to market demand. So I don't look for solutions, but what I look for maybe is a long-term muddling through process of self-correction that involves, you know, it involves the death of the old trees in the forest as well as the growth of the new ones.
Okay, Paul?
There's a couple of quick remarks. Is it on? Is it working?
I hear you fine, yeah.
Okay. I obviously agree with much of what you said about the current
problems with Europe, particularly with regard to the consequences of enlargement. But I was slightly puzzled by your understanding of the word institution, which you referred to many, many times. After all, if one looks at the development of European integration, one important aspect of that is the development of an enormous range of arrangements for common, I mean the buzzword now, governance. So that the bureaucracies, the governments of different member states are very, very strongly intertwined with each other in all sorts of ways. I mean, in fact, we do have a working European government over the wide range of arrangements in Europe. So I'm slightly puzzled by your understanding of the word institution. I wonder if I could sort of lead it to a conclusion. Maybe this is completely false. Is it the case that you're against government altogether? I mean, is it the case that you don't like the idea of institutions at all? Or, I mean, what is it that you understand by that term? Because if one understands that term as meaning processes of government, then Europe already has that to a very considerable degree.
You are a very challenging question, a very puzzled Paul.
I don't know that I can give you a satisfactory answer, but I can try. I mean, my answer is that European institutions, as they now function or do not function, don't scare me. I don't see any reason they should be eliminated because I don't think they're doing much. They operate within a framework of treaty-like agreements, such as the CAP, such as those for regional policy, that essentially are in place. What concerns me, but doesn't worry me terribly, is that they develop more such policies that work even less effectively. I wouldn't abolish them because I don't think they're doing much. I don't think anything's going to come of the Constitutional Convention. I don't think the EU has been unable to reform itself. I mean, you can't cite a more dramatic example than the CAP, which is not only an enormous waste of money and an expense imposed upon every imaginable group other than those who are actually producing or who own the land. It also has utterly warped the budget process in the EU. There's no conceivable way that even a person with your expertise could argue me into the position of accepting the fact that the budgetary process of the European Parliament, European institutions more generally, is uncomplicated, transparent, and responsive to democratic control. It is not. That is a central operating mechanism of governance within the framework of European institutions. You know, I mean, over half of the budget goes into CAP and cannot be touched. Another quarter of it, I mean, I'm using crude figures, goes into regional policy and cannot be touched unless it's possible to renegotiate the existing agreements with the beneficiaries of it. Good luck. What's left is a remnant of government in which the process of allocation is so immensely complicated that even experts who report on it literally can't understand it. So you can call it a system of governance if you want, but it's not one that operates properly. And it's one that I don't think has very, very much potential to develop. Unless, as I say, a real constitutional convention is called and the machinery of a federal Europe set up that place control in the hands of a European public. But that's not what anybody wants. So I don't see, I mean, it is a government, it is a law. But who makes the law, you know? It's a law that has a life unto it to itself and is not without challenges from places like Karlsruhe and so on and so forth. Of course it exists. The question is, how dangerous is it? Or is it a danger at all? Is it potentially a danger? And, you know, what is it worth to us as things now stand? And as I say, my view of it is that I'm not too worried about the institutions. I will be in the future because now, for the first time with enlargement, they're causing problems. problems unnecessarily. They're not solving them. You know, the Eastern Europeans have been led down a garden path, told that they should expect equality, that they would be treated like other Europeans, not like second-class Europeans, not like, you know, not like servants at the banquet, that all of this would come in time to pass. The entire political establishment in Eastern Europe, every government that's been in power up to date is committed to making this a success. What happens when the public begins to appreciate that there's no, that one of the four fundamental liberties guaranteed under the Treaty of Rome, freedom of mobility, is denied them, as it is, that they get to pay for the cap without enjoying but a small measure of its benefits, increasing to be sure over a period of, I believe it is 8 years, that they don't get the fat regional payments that go to Spain, Portugal, Greece, and even Ireland. And they can't. As long as those arrangements are in place, there isn't the money for it. That, in fact, they're getting a really rotten deal. This is all quite unnecessary. If they hadn't been promised that, they wouldn't. Their expectations wouldn't be what they are. They hadn't been told that, you know, that this is a great issue, the greatest that Europe has faced since World War II. It's a challenge, and we're up to it. If they hadn't been promised so much, the sense of disillusionment and letdown wouldn't be so great. So, as I say, the flags that I'm putting up really are flags for the future. As I say, I don't think that Monsieur Delors is putting us on a one-way track to superstate. The trouble is that he's left much of the European architecture in ruins. And in an effort to resume the integration process, the Commission and with the support of powerful relevant states are raising the ante. They're doing things that are completely unrealistic. Promising to reform the cap, that's a pretty good one. How about the Constitution? Is this really a constitutional convention in the sense that it's represented, like that event in Philadelphia? You know, it is not. Enlargement is a snare and a delusion. It's not going to work out, and it cannot work out unless the fundamental mechanisms of the community are redesigned.
So, colleague.
Your underlying thesis seems to be that although it's in a lot of trouble, European integration is a good thing, almost an inevitable thing. But we've got a European Union that's economically stagnating, politically undemocratic, institutionally corrupt and incompetent. As far as this country is concerned, the common fisheries policy has destroyed our fishing industry, common agriculture policies has distorted the countryside, our democracy is being transferred to Brussels, with Westminster becoming much more in a cipher, endless regulations being produced by bureaucrats without anything to being voted on by our own people, the corpus juris possibly going to be imposed, therefore ending British common law and imposing a Napoleonic code. Can you honestly see why we shouldn't just turn our backs on these 14 other nations and turn back to the world? And with the fourth largest economy in the world, go back to being a global nation and not a backwater of a stagnating superstate, if you like. And the other thing is, of course, that most of your arguments seem to be on the economic side, but the European Union is being driven by the self-interest of a pan-European bureaucratic and political elite. Now, as far as they're concerned, it doesn't matter if the economy doesn't work. For them and for their own personal self-interest, they'll keep going on it. And you seem to think it'll just sort of fade away. They'll never let it fade away. So, I mean, what mechanism do you think that suddenly the Commission will be sidelined entirely?
Well, that's because Iraq's going to become the 51st state. But if you'd like to join, there's a list outside, posted outside the door. But that's a good question, too. I think it's very important to try to view this issue of integration in, if you want, terms that go beyond the national. And I think I'm familiar with your complaints, and I think many of them are well justified, particularly on the fisheries policy. I think it's terrible that the legislatures of Europe are bloated with passing, you know, implementing measures for directives and regulations that are drafted up in Brussels without proper democratic input. These things trouble me. I do think that the powers of European parliaments have been seriously gutted by depriving them of the power of the purse. That is my main complaint against the EMU. I mean, there's no getting around that. You know, you know, you want monetary policy, you want fiscal policy. You better rethink what's gone on. Not the British, but everybody else in Europe. Seriously, better think about it, as they are doing. But this is all foreseeable. I mean, the economic literature on this, you know, is fairly is from the very first highly critical of the EMU. Okay, but the question is, why not just turn your back on it? I have two reasons for it. The first is because I really and truly believe that Britain plays an essential role in Europe. That's why I insist upon considering Mrs. Thatcher a good European, and that also holds for Tony Blair. Please don't throw a tomato. I know it's going to come from somewhere. I don't know whether it's going to be from this side or this side, but I can kind of hear them crashing around my still clean blazer. Okay, but I really and truly believe that both are following a traditional kind of British policy of being a balance wheel, a flywheel in Europe, and it's a constructive influence, and it's an example. And it comes at a cost. I mean, if I were British, I wouldn't want to be governed by Italians. I love Italians, I love Italy, I like the food, and there are many other things that I enjoy there far more than I enjoy here. But Italians don't want to be governed by Italians. So why should you? And why should you have to be? You know? But that doesn't mean leaving Europe. I think Britain has an essential role to play in it. The other point is, why not join the transatlantic alliance? The hard truth is, and it's painful to say, that we don't want it. I hate to tell you this, but Germany counts more for Europe than Britain does in the American view, in the view of the State Department, in the view of the Beltway, the inner Beltway people. There's no question about it. You know, what you are offering, what the British are offering, or what the British Euroskeptics would like to offer, and what Mrs. Thatcher has laid out in her book, is not what we want to accept. And so it's, you know, I think Robert Conquest was the first to make this proposal, at least at a high level, and it's unrealistic. It's not in the cards.
So which proposal?
Well, the proposal they should walk away from the European Union and join the United States in some sort of global
partnership.
Well, I thought that was the argument. That's Mrs. Thatcher said that, for instance, Britain should join NAFTA, that should then become the North Atlantic Free Trade Association, and this is the basis for a kind of a transatlantic condominium that would include Europe as an outlier, but also Latin America and anyone else we'd want to join. I mean, that's I take it the proposal that you're talking about, and I think it. Right? Yes, Clarence Stride. Yes, absolutely.
Well, John F. Kennedy.
No, not John F. Kennedy. That's another story.
He wanted an Atlantic Free Trade Association.
Yeah, but this was something that was anchored in, as I argue in the book, is in security policy and atomic, and that's quite different. Anyway, as far as the 52nd state, you know, the danger in that, we had some idea about that. Want to read a scary story? Read George Ball, the great genius of the American policy towards Europe in the early 1960s. He said, Britain should become to America, are you ready to be insulted? What Scotland is to Britain.
But Scotland runs Britain.
Sorry.
Scotland runs Britain. I say that as a Scot. Sorry, there's a gentleman over there who's next.
You mentioned the European European Constitution. What are the odds of a European president coming online?
How about zero? I don't think it has a chance. I think what will happen. And I don't have a crystal ball, and I certainly don't have any inside sources of information. I'm an historian, and I'm not a policy wonk, as they say. But look, they won't actually kill the thing. They'll just move it into another cycle, right? We started with the Declaration of Rights, human rights, right, that had such things as, you know, the right to have whatever it was, women's and men's toilets of equal size and every, you know. Really, it's like, you know, every company employing more than 500 employees, all this kind of thing. You know, fundamental rights, right? Let's not confuse them with, anyway, administrative law, regulations. Okay, so what will go on was, I don't know what comes after the European Constitutional Convention. That's such a grand enterprise that it's hard to imagine, but something will. Maybe they will, a new chapter of it will unfold. Maybe they'll have a new action plan. How about that? How about a new vision statement? How about that? These are things that Brussels is good at generating, and as long as we have trees, we'll have such proposals.
The Italian gentleman who I think flinched when you mentioned Italy a minute ago.
Sorry.
Good evening. No problem. Yeah, it's working. I apologize in advance because it's going to be more of a statement rather than, or a comment rather than a question, but would love you to comment on it. Well, as an Italian, we are famous because we had over 50 governments since our constitution. And our politics is not certainly the clearest in all over the place, I guess. But should we really give up a government? Should I really kind of avoid going to the polls and basically find somebody who in my place is going to make decisions which are going to affect everything I'm going to do when I'm back in Italy, from working to having my family and these kind of things? Well, this is certainly a bit cynical, but what I mean is that you say maybe to reduce the institutional, thin off institutions, and how about refining them? How about working on them as we're trying to do in Europe and in Italy, and I hope everywhere else?
I think you have a very constructive position, and I perhaps overstated what's often been said, and that is that Italians would prefer to be governed from Brussels than from Rome. But I think there's a lot of truth in that. I do think that the Italians have made a tremendous effort to be good, constructive Europeans and made huge sacrifices, especially in the 90s, to qualify for the EMU. I wish I could tell you that I thought the effort had been worthwhile. What it did was wreck the Italian left and bring Berlusconi back into power. Today, you know, the only coherent political force in Italy. So it's not a story with a happy ending. But it's a noble one. It is a noble story, and it's one that Italians are willing to pay very heavily for, in terms of economic growth and increased taxes. Unfortunately, I don't think it worked. And the man, of course, one of the men most responsible for this policy, is now the European Commission president.
All right, quick comeback. Defend Italy then.
Not that I voted for Berlusconi or anything, but do you think that the past terms of Berlusconian government have damaged more Italy than the past 40 years of democratic Christians and maybe the 10 years more or less of the left?
I certainly don't think they're worse than the DC. That's for sure. I think it's sadly better than the left. That's all I can say. I wish it were still better. And you know, when you see that Berlusconi's two most important achievements are eliminating the inheritance tax, right, and providing an amnesty for flight capital, you have to say this man is moving in a traditional direction.
Well, I think that stunned everyone. So, on a high note, Mr. Signor Berlusconi, I thank you very much for giving us an excellent lecture and answering some very tricky questions. Thanks very much, John.
Thanks.